Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Whatever happens today, plan to conquer it with a fresh cup of True Brew Coffee. True North Convenience Store's True Brew Coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. Our brew is truly perfect for any time of the day. During October and November, enter for a chance to win free coffee for a year. Check the True Rewards app for details or find the mobile app in your favorite app store. Offer valid 10/7 through 12/1. True Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I'm caught up in the game. My attention is on every play and every whistle. But what I'm missing is a signal coming from my kidneys. That signal isn't like a ref's whistle. It's more of a silent SOS, which could be warning me of an increased risk for events like heart attack or stroke. And a way I can catch that signal? A simple urine test called UACR. If you have type 2 diabetes or high blood pressure, talk to your doctor about the UACR test. Detect the SOS. Visit detecttheSOS.com to learn more.
Good evening and welcome to Amplify, a telephone talk show that looks at life from a religious perspective. I'm Father Ron Lingwin, hoping that you have felt the warmth of God's love in your life this day, especially the joy you feel when you share God's love with others. As we do each week, I'd like to begin our program with a story that is based on faith and formed with imagination. The title of this particular story is simply, The Soul. Jesus sat and gently touched a piece of new cloth. It was a gift from his mother, and he could feel the love in it, the love with which she had made it. Mary Magdalene was pleased, for she could see how much he loved it, even though he didn't say anything. She sat down and asked him, Master, what is our purpose in life? Is it to weave cloth like your mother has done? To work in the fields, to teach, to be a mother, to suffer like the untouchables? Master, what is our purpose? Jesus looked at her with love in his eyes and said, Mary, Mary Magdalene, if only I knew. I think we are placed upon the earth to learn and to care for one another. It took a long time, but my mother made this cloth with great love. Life is like this cloth. We weave a different pattern every day. Some days are good and some are bad. Some are filled with sorrow, some with love, and some with pain. Some days we seem to be all alone, but I tell you this, there is a soul in each of us. It is a gift no man can give us. It is a gift from the Father. It is such a precious gift that man forgets its importance. But we can't see it, Mary Magdalene said. If it's so precious and so important, why can't we see it? Jesus smiled and said, Woman, woman, why is it that man is not satisfied unless he can see, touch, feel, or hear something? Maybe the Father gave each of us a soul that belongs to us and us alone, so precious a gift that no one else can see, hear, touch, or feel it except you and you alone. Only you know what is on your soul and in it. Only you and the Father who gave it to you. A story of faith and imagination. Our guest this evening writes in part one of his book titled In Search of the Common Good, Christian Fidelity in a Fractured World. It's been 60 years since W.H. Auden wrote his lengthy poem, The Age of Anxiety. In the time since, we have, if anything, become more anxious than ever. Christians worry over the continued life of their religious communities and institutions. In the political sphere, both left and right, they look to the future with concern, struggling to identify a sure path toward flourishing. Neither side can agree on the goods they wish to pursue together, so that the triumphs of the right appear as catastrophic defeats for the left, and vice versa. In such a society, it is very hard to discern any sort of common good that can unify us. We need to begin by defining the problem as it exists today. First, we must face the fact that many of the wounds contributing to the American church's decline are self-inflicted. Though American Christians do have genuine opponents in the public square and elite institutions, they have often been their own worst enemies, making disastrous political compromises and looking the other way when sin is exposed in their midst. When addressing that sin would require sacrifices they have deemed too costly or risks deemed too dangerous. A conservative columnist once used the phrase, decline is a choice, when describing American foreign policy. Something similar applies to the decline of the American church. Our decline is a predictable product of choices we have made. If it is to be arrested, we must understand the bad choices we have made and discern how the course they set us on can be corrected. Yet, it is not merely America's religious life that is in decline. Most of its other communities are failing as well. Families and businesses and neighborhoods and cities and voluntary organizations have all been diminished in recent years. The result is rampant loneliness, a longing for anything that offers some kind of solace, and ultimately a society where the only thing we really share is a desperation for community and the besetting doubt that we will ever experience those goods. Our guest is Jake Meter. He is vice president of the Davenant Institute and editor of chief of Mere Christianity, and that's an online magazine covering Christian faith in the public sphere. His work has been published in First Things, National View, Books and Culture, Christianity Today, Front Porch Republic, and the University Brookman. He lives with his wife and children in his hometown of Lincoln, Nebraska. Jack Meter, welcome to Amplify.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about what it's like in Lincoln, Nebraska, where you live. Are you in the midst of this
backyard?
Yeah. Oh, you're
what?
Sitting in your backyard.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, I'm sitting in my backyard because it's the first day in a week where it's not been like 95 or higher.
Yes.
So
yes.
Having an actual pleasant temperature outside
Wonderful.
Is nice.
Wonderful.
But yeah, Lincoln has just always been home to me. My grandfather came here in the 1940s. He was born in a small farming community a couple hours north of here. And after the war, he came back and married a woman that he had been writing letters back and forth with during the war. He was in Southeast Asia and she was in Boston. And he came back, they got married and moved to Lincoln. And my family's been here ever since. My mom's lived in the exact same neighborhood for almost her whole life, actually. So,
and
roots are deep here.
Yeah, I asked that question because that's how you begin your book, about the importance of your home, where you learn so much about the Christian community. And and there was some struggle in there because there was a time when you did not profess Christianity, did you?
I don't think I would ever go that far. There was a time where I wasn't sure if I wanted to be a Christian or not. So it was touch and go, but I don't think I ever would have just denied being a Christian. I was blessed with some good reading companions in high school, even if I didn't have like friends in the church that I was working through stuff with as much. I was reading Lewis and a Presbyterian missionary named Francis Schaeffer.
Yes.
And so the two of them were kind of always in my ear, even at my angriest. And so I don't know that I ever totally gave it up, but I was tempted.
No, I should have known that, because that's one of the things you say, that a lot of people are angry and leave the church, and it's not really something they should do. But we'll get to that. Let me read again. You write, "This book, then, is not simply about the decline of the evangelical church in America, although we must discuss that first. It's about the broader question of how we build flourishing communities shaped by the truths taught in the Christian faith. The goal is not merely to see the faith passed on to our children, but also to see others enter the community and similarly be nourished and in time drawn to Christ themselves. And much of that has to do with the question of place, home, and the daily practices that shape those places. Old Testament scholar Walter Brueggemann says that our current crisis is not one of meaninglessness, but rootlessness. Quote, there are no meanings apart from roots." And just to give people a sense of your book, and I'm not going to do it justice, there's so many things that jumped out at me, and I'll be thinking about, I have like 8 pages of things, quotes from your book and questions and things, and you write about everywhere in the world there is something that calls us to God. Another place, "The world we know today has been hallowed out, made into something base and utterly devoid of true mystery. The first step," you write, "toward reunion with God is simply believing the promises of God as they are offered in the gospel. And at best, our life in this world is simply an opportunity to tell people about God, the gospel, heaven, and hell." And through all that you talk about in this book, you end up speaking about how Christians can be a powerful force for good in the life of their community. And you believe there's a short-term and a long-term reason for hope. And that's where I wouldn't want to live here. You point out that spiritual leaders and others failed you, but your parents' home and the simple life they had together never did. And the fact also that we can look to Scripture to better understand what is happening in the church today and why. And so you talk about that throughout the book. Tell us a little bit about how the American church, you believe, has failed both Catholics and evangelicals. And you talk at the very beginning of the book that Catholics are very much a part of what is happening. It's not just Catholics. Maybe I should say that, because we're in the news more than anyone else, but others are also.
Yeah. I think one of the, there's a anecdote I've come across. I've heard it ascribed to Francis of Assisi and Thomas Aquinas, and who knows the origin, but the story goes that, I'll say Thomas because that's the first way I heard it. Thomas is riding into this great medieval city, and he meets with one of the local church officials there, and the church official is showing him the great buildings that they've built and these marvelous churches and all this ostentatious display of wealth, even the robes that he's wearing. And he finishes it all, and he looks at Thomas, and he says, "No more must St. Peter say, silver and gold have I none." And Thomas looks at him and kind of mournfully says, "But neither can he say, rise, take up your bed, and walk," referencing the Acts 4 story. I think that story says a lot about what the problem is. I think in both cases, evangelicals and Catholics alike became very comfortable, and we became very at home with a certain level of cultural recognition, power, acceptability, And thus, what often happened is when sin came up in our midst, we did more to protect our status than we did to deal with the sin. I mean, you can think about how many of the stories about the Catholic abuse scandal talk about some priest or some bishop who didn't want the truth exposed, talked about not or avoiding scandal. And the same thing has happened in evangelical circles. There's actually just a very sad story of over the last few days, former pastor named Joshua Harris, who wrote a book called I Kiss Dating Goodbye when he was, I think he wrote it when he was 19. It was published when he was 21 or something like that. He and his wife of, I think, 20 years announced that they're separating late last week. And without getting into the full tale, there was just a lot of ugliness that they were actually subjected to over many years, and they were kind of abandoned by their spiritual mentors. And now they are still, years later, dealing with the fallout from this. And yes. When the mentor first abandoned him, everyone rushed to this guy's defense. And yet now, in hindsight, it looks like he really destroyed this young man who he had really used in a way, and nobody wanted to confront it because we like being comfortable. We like having a good image of our leaders, and confronting realities about these things, I think, is really scary and really painful. And yet the flip side to that is that the victims of abusive leadership are abandoned, and people see that. And over time, they lose confidence in Christians as being actually interested in loving neighbor, in protecting the weak, in advocating for the marginalized, because we come to look like any other kind of, sorry, there's an ambulance coming by my house. We start looking like any other kind of political advocacy organization that is chiefly there to protect its own status and protect its power. And we are more concerned with that than we are with fidelity to Christ. Because sometimes fidelity to Christ is costly.
Yes.
Often it is.
Yes.
And yet we've been very reluctant to pay that cost when it's going to cost us power and influence and comfort.
You write that failure for some religious leaders has become a mark of honor. They are broken like the rest of people. And as I said in introducing you, you still have hope. You indicate you believe we're passing into exile, but in exile there is hope. The American Republic is faring no better than the American church, and a church that loses hidden faith will not be able to sustain public faith. And then you write, the failure of the American church is that we have become indifferent to the heart. This is because fidelity of the heart will compel us toward an external fidelity that is frequently uncomfortable, demanding, and dangerous. Say just a little, I just have a minute till the first break. Just say a little bit more about what you're saying here.
When you're in a society like America that values personal peace and affluence, and you're in a church that values the same, if you're committed to something greater than personal peace and affluence, that will place demands on you, and it will also be seen as a threat to the people around you, because it implicitly it's a rebuke. It's a declaration that there's something greater than personal peace and affluence, and I'm called to it, and you are too, because you're also made in God's image. And there's something very jarring about that, because Jesus doesn't leave you alone when he calls you.
Right.
He will disrupt your life.
Okay, we're going to take this break. When we come back, we're going to talk about, Jake speaks about the delight we experience over the course of ordinary life together is connected to the Christian story. We're going to ask him a little bit about that. So we'll be back to talk about In Search of the Common Good. We are speaking with Jake Meter, who's the author of a book called The Search of the Common Good, Christian Fidelity in a Fractured World. And one of the things he writes in the book is the moral precepts that follow claims made by Christianity are not optional practices meant to help enrich an individual Christian's personal experience. They are rather moral norms that follow from claims about the basic nature of reality. And Jake, you heard the warning here. So yes, it's been hot here like you're experiencing, but we have a whole bunch of flooding, and I'm right in that area, southwestern Pennsylvania. The county's in the corner where there's a great deal of flooding. As you know, sometimes that when the cold front comes down and mixes with all that heat, there are just violent storms. And so we would want people to, look to all the places you can for the weather. Certainly listen to the news, and there'll be more information during the course of the evening. You write in your book that when the church fails to preach the gospel faithfully and submit its life to the lordship of Christ, the effects are not limited to the church. Religious life and common life decline together. And perhaps that's part of what you say later, that there is despair in modern America. Tell us what you believe is going on in the country now, country and church.
Yeah, so when you turn to civil society, what started this whole process for me is at the same time that I was reading Rusty Reno's Resurrecting the Idea of a Christian Society, Dangerous to Believe by Mary Eberstadt, Benedict Option by Rod Dreher, all of which are books I appreciate and admire in many ways. At the same time I was reading those, I was reading George Packer's Unwinding and J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy and, some books are slipping my mind now, Charles Murray Coming Apart, later Sarah Smarsh's Heartland. And so there's all these books that are just chronicling civil decline in the U.S., stories of people for whom the American dream has not worked out the way they thought it would. And then as I dug into the social science data, a lot of the things I was seeing there fit with these books I was reading. If you trust the Gallup employee engagement data, about 2/3 of Americans are disengaged in their day-to-day work, which means they're not really emotionally into it. They are looking for other work. They don't care that much about how their company does or how their work affects the company. Half of all Americans would say they don't have a significant conversation with another person on a daily basis. And that doesn't have to mean some kind of like hour-long heart-to-heart. That can mean I get home and I sit down with my roommate and I had a rough day and I can tell him about it. Like, this isn't huge stuff. This is just the ordinary things of day-to-day life that make life enjoyable for us. This study by Cigna said that half of Americans don't have that. There's other similar studies out there. And it just tells the story of a nation that's very lonely, that has growing levels of depression and anxiety. If you look at the rising generation, Gen Z, so I'm a millennial, the generation after me that's now in college and younger, our colleges do not have the resources they need to service the mental health needs of their student body because of how much anxiety and depression has spiked with this rising generation.
Jake,
and so that's kind of a canary in the coal mine situation, yeah. I think.
Thanks.
Sorry.
Hold on a second. We have another warning at this point.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Welcome back to Amplify. We have to that latest warning that includes Pittsburgh, where I am, and communities all around us. So, Jake, enjoy it sitting in your backyard tonight. There's no concern here. We sit at the top of a hill, but it's all the people at the bottom of the hill who catch all the rain. One of the points you talk about, and I think it's an important one, tell us a little bit about the existentialist story and why it believes, not you believe, why it believes the solution, that it is the solution to, that the solution every, let me get this, that it believes that the solution to every problem is more freedom.
Yes. So in the third chapter of the book, I'm trying to outline what is the kind of basic underlying narrative that people tell themselves to make sense of their lives. I think this is something Stanley Hauerwas says, and a Ugandan Catholic theologian named Emmanuel Katongole has said it as well, that we live according to stories. Stories that tell us what the good life is, what the good community is, what we should aspire to, what we should, what our ambitions should be. And the dominant story that we have today, I think, in the West is this existentialist narrative that basically says you enter the world as this undefined, kind of amorphous being, and you define yourself over the course of your life through your actions, your choices, your work, your what you do with your money. All of these things are kind of meaning-making, identity-making things that we have. And so because we enter the world in that way, any kind of thing that curtails our ability to make those kind of free choices is suspect, because you are an autonomous individual, and who is that person or that community or that institution to tell you what you can and can't do with your freedom? So the way Hauerwas sums it up is he said that we believe that I have no story except the story I chose when I had no story. So everything is kind of up for grabs and negotiable. The problem with this is that that story in itself actually condemns us to a great deal of loneliness, because a lot of the best things in life that make life delightful, that give us things to live for, will at times impinge on our freedom. The Catholic journalist J.D. Flynn has this great story. I don't remember if he just posted it on social media or if he wrote it somewhere, but he was talking about being in an airport and meeting this couple. I don't think they were married, no kids, both very successful professionally, and they were kind of globe travelers. And so they were telling him that they did these trips because they were in search of authentic human experiences. And JD's comment that in my mind I was like, I had an authentic human experience last night. My child crawled into bed and then threw up on me.
Yes.
And it's a kind of a gross story, but like those are the things you like. I've had a similar experience with my kids. It's worth it. It's what gives you a sense of rootedness and identity. It gives you something to come home to. And so I can't be as free and unattached as someone like either part of that couple that JD met at the airport. Because if I wanted to cash in a bunch of credit card points and hop on a plane and go to London or go to wherever, sure, there's a part of me that thinks that would be fun. My wife and children would have something to say about that, and that's good, actually. But it does infringe on what you can do in terms of just the sheer number of choices in front of you. These communities that tell us who we are and anchor us, these virtues that we aspire to as followers of Christ do necessarily limit our choices. And that is the thing that's not tolerable in the existentialist story, because the existentialist story is the good life is maximizing the amount of choices you have and then actualizing yourself, creating yourself even by choosing those choices and living with whatever comes from them.
And you point out that it ultimately fails because what happens when my freedom comes into competition with yours?
Right. There's the Christian idea about the world is that there is a natural order to reality. God made the world to work in a certain way. And so when you just, and that way, that's how we have harmony. That's how we mm-hmm. have mutually beneficial relationships, is that I find that maybe I'm a farmer, and I find that as I take care of my land and I take care of my animals, the land gets better. My animals get healthier. My farm is healthier. As I'm in a marriage and I care for my wife and love her, I parent my children, those things get better. Like we serve each other and we find peace and love in those relationships. Mm-hmm. If you want to pretend that this order doesn't exist and that we can do basically whatever we want with reality, I have a friend who says that we think that reality is Plato. And so if we think that reality is Plato and I can shape the Plato however I want and there isn't any order I'm accountable to, well, there are other people that I'm going to be accountable to because yes. they're going to want to shape the Plato too. And ultimately, then all you're left with is naked power, and whoever's the strongest or the least principled can shape the Plato however they want, because they're going to use power to gain control and do what they want, and the other people will suffer. But that's really all you're left with once you reject that order, and we just have kind of raw material in the world. Well, then it's just Darwinianism and survival of the fittest, and that's not actually a good world for anybody, even the people that win, because they end up lonely and isolated. But it's certainly not a good world for the weak, for those on the margins, which is what we're seeing today.
Yes. You write about the loss of wonder, pointing out that everywhere in the world there is something that calls us to God. And one of the examples that you used was just the birds. And my sister and I, right outside of this back enclosed porch we have with glass, there's this tree, small tree, that is not 2 feet away from the window. And a robin gave birth to five others in that. And I'm home like once a week, basically, but my sister watched that, and I watched it almost the whole time I was there. It was just fascinating how the mother and the father took care of them and chased the other birds away that may have tried to harm, and, you know, spent all day feeding them. And it was, I could go on and on and on. You know exactly what I'm talking about. But so many things like that, aren't there? That there's just this, so much happening around us that shows us the presence of God, that God is calling out to us. We're losing our sense, I think, of that, as we turn to so much of the advancements in technology, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's striking. I don't think I had noticed it until a few years ago in our church to the Bible study, going through it, but the book of Job, it's impossible to make sense of the book of Job if we can't look at the created world around us and learn true things about God from that. That's God's entire appeal to Job at the end of the book, is I want you to look at these stars. I want you to look at these creatures. I want you to look at the weather. I want you to look at all of these things, and you should be learning things about me from looking. And Jesus makes the same move in the Sermon on the Mount.
Yes.
Jesus' response to anxiety is go look at some flowers. And, I mean, the funny thing is, there was actually a piece that I think was the New York Times had a few years ago, where they were talking about anxiety in these young people in high school and college. And one of the places that the reporter went is they went to this retreat center that does treatment for anxiety, particularly with young people. And a lot of the treatments that they have them doing are go and take care of some horses, go for a walk in the woods. And it's like, this is just the Sermon on the Mount.
Yes.
And it took us a long time and probably a lot of money in research to end up at the Sermon on the Mount. But I think there, and that's not to say that other, like, there are many other ways that we can and should respond to anxiety. I don't want to minimize or dismiss those. But I think when you look at the Sermon on the Mount, Christ seems to assume, I can tell these people to look at the birds, look at those flowers, and they can do that and learn something that's true about me and that's true about the world. And Scripture is just filled with those kind of assumptions in the way that the biblical writers will argue.
And you point out that beauty can confront us in things both small and large, and that there is very little about the world as we encounter it daily that is mysterious to us, because when you talk about, you write about the challenge of disenchantment, that the world we know today has been hallowed out, made into something base and utterly devoid of true mystery. And so we've got to learn to look at the world as we once knew it and experienced it. You write, there is a relationship between disenchantment and communal life. Both are premised on the idea that myself is porous and can be penetrated and transformed by the world that exists outside of myself. So we're going to take this break, and then we'll be back. Welcome back to the second hour of Amplify, where our guest this evening is Jake Meter. We're talking about his book, In Search of the Common Good, Christian Fidelity in a Fractured World. And we may, during this second hour also, have a warning, which we will break for. A lot of flooding going on in western Pennsylvania while Jake sits in his backyard. And hopefully, and really enjoying. He's an hour different than us too. It's the 9 o'clock hour for him. Jake writes in the book The Loss of Good Work and points out that many young Americans accept a lifestyle that requires us to renounce a great many of the relational pleasures that provide a sense of long-term happiness and purpose in our lives. And then indicates that a name for a person who renounces many of life's ordinary pleasures to dedicate all their mental and physical resources to a singular good are called monks. But today's secular monks, he point out, are quite different from their predecessors. And I've known many monks in my life. He talks about work, that work has been hallowed out, transformed, and far removed from its original meaning, and that there are a number of changes that have taken place in the nature of work, both a sociological shift and an economic shift. And I was really surprised to see this figure, that globally 87% of workers are disengaged from their work, and 51% of American workers. Jake, speak to us a little bit about the loss of good work.
Yeah. So I do want to flag Leah Labresco is the one who had the sad secular monks column in First Things. And I got that line from her. And that's an excellent column. So if anybody wants to hunt that down in First Things archives, it's very much worth your time. What I think happens with work, the story I tell at the start of the chapter is a close friend of mine was a junior in college and was clearly very talented, was going to go on to do grad school, was probably going to get into a pretty good PhD program. And if anybody had a shot at finding a tenure-track gig in the humanities with a land-grant university undergrad degree, it would be this guy. And before his junior year was over, he was talking to his advisor, and his recently divorced advisor, I'll note, and he told him that he was getting married that summer. And his advisor was kind of scandalized by this and was like, oh, you shouldn't do that. It's a mistake. And he explained in very kind of pragmatic terms that you will not have time to be married while you're in grad school. Mm. You will be learning languages and writing papers and presenting at conferences. And marriage would be a hindrance to that, and to say nothing of children would be a horrible hindrance to that. Similarly, there's a clip floating around on YouTube of the guy who started Shark Tank, giving this talk at a university where he was asked about this young man who had a pretty successful small business, asked him for his advice because his fiance, this business owner's fiance, was not happy with how much time he was working. And this, I think it was Kevin O'Leary, this very successful businessman, looked at the guy and he said, well, what's easier to replace, your fiance or your business?
Hmm. Yes.
And that was his method of handling the dispute. And so for the successful people, you have the sad secular monk phenomenon where they make a great deal of money and they gain a great deal of cultural recognition, success, and yet they don't have time for ordinary pleasures of life with friends. They probably have had to move a long way away from their friends in order to chase success in the first place. Because a lot of the health, if you want to call it that, in the American economy right now is concentrated around cities, and a small number of cities even in a lot of cases. So I've been fortunate. I was born in Lincoln, and so I was able to find work here after I graduated. A lot of people don't have that privilege. A lot of the people I was in school with at UNL were from small towns in Nebraska, and they knew there was no future for them there. And they would have to move at minimum to Lincoln or Omaha to find work after they graduated, at least work of the sort they wanted to be doing and that would allow them to have a family. And so that's what you have at the top of the income bracket for Americans, is work as this all-consuming thing that crowds out family and crowds out friendship and just controls your whole life. But for the people who don't have access to those kind of privileged positions and work, it's not any better, actually, because they have wage stagnation. Most studies, I know there's some dispute about this, but several studies would say that American wages have been pretty stagnant since the 80s. They have stagnant wages. They probably are taking these gig economy jobs with Uber or Lyft or Instacart or something similar to kind of pad out their income. So they're working a ton of hours. They're not making much money from it. They don't have much ownership over the work. They're very much a kind of cog in the machine. And so it's a very emotionally detached kind of work for them. And they go through much of their life kind of on autopilot, just doing the job they need to do. And then the return for that is probably stress about health care, because they probably won't be able to afford good health insurance. Anxiety about how they're going to pay back student loans. And the solace of very small, trivial pleasures that the economy affords to us, like Netflix. There was a lecture I heard Patrick Deneen give. He's the author of Why Liberalism Failed. He's a political scientist at Notre Dame. And he said, we should learn a lot from the simple fact that most generations prior, when young people came into adulthood, they received an inheritance from the generation that came before them. And when our young people today come into adulthood, they enter it in debt because of student loan.
Yes.
And that fact alone should tell us something about the priorities of our economy. There's a Catholic writer I like a lot named Matthew Walter who says that our problem is we have an economy rather than a society. And I think that's a good line. And so work becomes this all-consuming thing that may or may not be satisfying, but almost certainly doesn't leave much room for other things.
When you get to part three of your book, titled The Practices of Community, you write, so far I have sketched a bleak picture of the contemporary United States, both in the sphere of religion and common life more generally. I have also outlined the reasons for our national malaise, which concerns the felt loss of meaning, wonder, and the absence of good, sustainable work. Now I turn to hope. In the face of such darkness, what legitimate grounds do we have for hope? There are two sources. First, human creatures must hope because they themselves are proof of the abundant, overflowing life of the transcendent God. In our embodied life, in a physical world, we are a constant reminder of the life of God, who is perfectly complete and content in himself and created out of that abundance. Our Creator is filled to the brim with joy. One day, we will be too. That's the long-term reason for hope. What's the short-term reason, Jake? If there is one.
Yeah. So there's a certain sense Wendell Berry has sounded similar concerns throughout his life and in his work, and somebody asked him about being a pessimist or an optimist, and he said that, I don't think you have the right to be either. I think you must hope, because you must believe that there are ways that you can demand something of yourself and be faithful to that. If you can do that, then presumably other people can as well, and so you have grounds for hope. It's a quiet kind of thing, and it's not going to be, for some years, revolutionary enough, I imagine. Which is not to say we don't need major changes in our society to make it more just. We do. But I think for a lot of people, they're not going to be in positions to create that kind of change. And so we have to find other ways in our day-to-day lives of offering a still better way of living in God's world. And so the argument of part three is that in recovering Sabbath as a practice, something we're committed to, in recovering a thicker conception of membership in our local places, beginning in our homes but working outward, and then in recovering an idea of work as service to our local place, first and foremost, we can start in small ways to try and reach into an alternative world, a different kind of world that more fully reflects God's intention for his people. And so Sabbath is a big part of that, and that's the beginning, because it reminds us that we're made for God. So when we work, we're ordered to what Rabbi Heschel, who has a great book on the Sabbath, calls the world of space. It's physical things that are around us all the time. It's money. It's my job. But when we practice Sabbath, Heschel says we're ordered to the world of time. And so we're reminded that we are made for something more than making money, something more than having a big house. We're made to know God. And that in practicing Sabbath, we actually are imitating God in a way. So I think that would be a start, is just trying to recover a good practice of Sabbath. And that means gathering with God's people for worship. But I think it also means more than that. I think it means reminding ourselves that there are greater and more beautiful things than the things we dream of in the world of space during the week. And it also is a chance for us to practice a kind of holy indifference to the market economy that exists around us. It's a chance for us to say, I'm not going to work today. I'm going to give myself to my friends, to leisurely time together, to enjoying God's world. And I'm not going to be obsessed with dollars and cents, as many of us are, often out of necessity during the week.
Now, you point out that when we observe Sabbath, we are orienting ourselves to God, who we meet by faith. And I love the simplicity of this part of that chapter. You ask the question, what does Sabbath mean for us today? Don't overthink it. We go to church. I love that.
Mm-hmm.
Don't overthink it. We go to church. Why is public worship so important?
So when you start with the idea that your identity is narrated by you through your life, the quote-unquote communities that you participate in will almost all be affinity-based, or they'll grow out of material necessity. So I need to eat. I need to pay my bills. So I have this very thin kind of community at my work. I like soccer, and I go to the pub and watch games with my friends. Mm-hmm. And so we have a community around this thing that we like. And those kind of communities don't demand much of you in certain ways. Whereas when you are part of a church, you, at least like in my denomination, we take vows when we become members. And so there was one time we were there was a baby being baptized, and when we raised our hand saying that we vowed to assist the parents in raising that child in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. So the pastor asks us if we take that vow, and then we raise our hands and say we do. And the pastor laughs and he goes, "Look at all those Sunday school volunteers."
Right.
And so, like, we're thrust into this community together, and there will be people that you will meet in your church that will drive you crazy. There are people that you will meet in your church that will wrong you, and you're going to be stuck with them. And you have to learn to be able to be in that place with them in the midst of that. And so you are forced to practice forgiveness and reconciliation, because otherwise the community is not going to work. There's something in the latest issue of Plow, which is this magazine published by an Anabaptist group called the Bruderhof.
Yes.
And there's an interview in there with one of their members where he talks about, I'm paraphrasing, but the gist of the quote was, "We're stuck together. We've taken lifelong vows," and in their case, they've taken lifelong vows of poverty, they've renounced private property, and they are living together. And if they don't practice forgiveness, if they don't practice being reconciled to people that wronged them, there's no hope for their community. And so when you're in church, you really are forced to practice at loving the people you're stuck with. And I think that's a really important virtue to acquire. I have a friend who talks about hospitality, and he said a lot of people think about hospitality as having friends over and family over and things like that. He's like, that's good. Like, everybody enjoys having friends over, eating dinner, opening a bottle of wine. Like, who doesn't like that? But he said hospitality, as Christianity would understand it, is inviting strangers. And so it's a different kind of thing, and it's more demanding. And I think church teaches us just a relational, or it should teach us a relational openness to the stranger,
mm-hmm.
and it should teach us patience in our relationships, because we're not going to have common affinities with people that we meet within church. We're not going to be depending on them in our day job, and yet we are with them in a real sense going through life. And we have to be able to make those communities work, even hard.
Let me take us out to the last part of our program, and when we take a break, final break, to part four. As we get there, there are various things that I have underlined. The three norms to recover the common life are work, home, and Sabbath. You write that our problems are deeply human, and so too must be the solutions. The first step toward reunion with God is simply believing the promises of God as they are offered in the gospel. One way, and I'm skipping around so our people know that. I just want to show them there's a lot here in this book that I can't cover during this program. One way of reading modern history is as the story of how people have sought to free themselves from unchosen restraints. Time exposes what we have made of our lives, what we have done with our freedom. It exposes how far we have wandered from God. The Sabbath reminds us we can't carry on this way forever. And then you talk about membership and the lifeboat metaphor that hopefully people will want to read in your book, In Search of the Common Good, is its title. And you write, when we give ourselves entirely to contentment and gratitude to God, we are participating in the life of His membership. And then the questions I raise, how does the Lord draw our eyes toward the beauty of His world and the goodness of His law? And then as you write about work, you discuss the goodness of work, the sacramental work that produces wealth, and how sacramental work is attentive to the membership. And so we're going to take this final break, and then we'll be back. Welcome back to the final segment of Amplify, that we'll be ending about 10 minutes before the hour. And our guest is Jake Meador. We're talking about his book, In Search of the Common Good. It's a very spiritual book. I mean, it's a very, well, it is a spiritual book, no question about it. But I mean, it brings together the problems we're facing in the world in which we live and helps us to understand how it is we need to address them as the Christians that we are. And part four is titled The Promise of Community. And Jake writes in part of that, both doctrine and virtue are so important. The most basic and proper work of Christian citizenship is to cultivate the virtues of humility and wisdom in order to make oneself a gifted public servant in whatever venue God has called one to. By understanding the basic Christian political doctrines, as well as the civil virtues, we can equip ourselves to repair the fracturing body politic of America and to offer a positive vision of mutual flourishing and hope in our decadent society. And that's why you might want to buy a copy of this book. And Jake, at the beginning of this part of the book, you pose this question: what hope is there for those who cling to a crucified king and call a wandering world to faith? And you have two reasons. Amplify on them for us, if you will.
So I think the primary reason is something you quoted from already, is that we worship a God who is faithful to his promises. And so God is not going to fail us, even when all the religious leaders in the world fail us. And even when our kind of social structures fail us by creating these places where loneliness is just kind of hardwired into the system, we trust that God is still at work, often in ways that we can't see. Mm-hmm. I think the other piece, and this is what Chapter 9 is about, is Chapter 9 is trying to begin to sketch out some Christian ideas about politics and how we function in that sphere. The first question we should be asking is, where do good citizens come from? And one of the problems that I think the religious right has had for many years is that we've skipped that question, and we've gone straight to, well, we want to win this policy debate, we want to pass this law, so we need to get this court justice appointed, and so we can justify any number of horrible things because we're going to get that one discrete policy win. And we obviously just did this with President Trump and the Supreme Court very recently. The first question I think we need to ask is, where do citizens come from, and how do we cultivate those virtues within our communities? And if we can, again, going back to Barry, if we can demand something of ourselves and in humble reliance on God to do the work, we can be faithful to that demand, then we have grounds for hope in some limited way. And so I think if we can, in small groups, in churches and parishes, denominations, if we can say to ourselves, we want to cultivate maturity, we want to cultivate humility, we want to cultivate wisdom in our people so that we can offer virtuous civil leadership wherever God has put us, then we can begin in small ways to repair civil society. We can be exemplars of what the good life is, and we can do that in churches, but we can do it outside of churches. It doesn't have to be limited to that. We can be generous with our time and resources and how we do our work. Yes. We can be generous with our neighbors, and we can be a safe place for people who are wounded. That's another reason, actually, that the blind eye that we've turned to abuse is so evil, because it tells other victims that we are not to be trusted. And that's a horrible thing for people who have been exploited, taken advantage of, hurt, to be taught by Christians through our actions that we are not to be trusted, that we are not the refuge. I think about the scene in the opening pages of Les Mis, which is maybe one of the defining, I don't know that I quote it in the book, but it's something that's always in my mind. When Valjean comes to that town at the beginning of the story, he's hungry, he's tired, he's discouraged, he's angry. He gets turned away at every door, and then he's sitting in the middle of the square, and a woman comes up to him and asks him what he's doing. And he says, I'm going to sleep here tonight because no one will take me in, and I'm a convict, and no one will have me. The woman knows that he couldn't have knocked on the priest's door because the priest wouldn't turn him away. And she says, go knock on that door. And he's welcomed. And that's the beginning of what changes his life, and it ends up changing a town where he rules virtuously as a mayor. It changes the life of an orphaned girl who he takes in. The ripples of that encounter with that priest in the beginning of the story are enormous. And the reason it happens is because that priest is known to be safe. And so when we can, in our small Christian communities, live in such ways that our neighbors know we are safe, it seems small. And I said this before, I think the book might frustrate some people because it will not seem sufficiently radical. And maybe it isn't, but I don't know. I need to think about it. But I think when we can live lives of exemplary love, that will be noticed, particularly in a society marked by such loneliness, it will be noticed. And if we can be trusted, you are struggling with this, go to the Christian. They will love you and support you. When we have that kind of reputation, then we have the ability to be a remarkable agent for healing and renewal, even in a world that is as fractured as this one. But for that to happen, we must take sin seriously. We must take holiness seriously.
Dare I amplify on your answer about hope?
Yeah.
But you write, first, there is the simple hope that flows naturally out of the spirit-enlightened heart upon hearing the gospel presented. The good news of the gospel is really good news, not just about some future state of bliss, but about the state of our world today. Blessing routinely comes when created beings hear and respond to the call of their Creator. When you stand in truth, you stand with hope, confidence, and boldness. These characteristics should define us as Christians. So first, we recognize that the Christian message tells us the truth about ourselves as individuals and about the nature of our life together with our neighbors. Second, Christians can hope because God, who made and sustains the world, has spoken, has entered the world, has conquered sin and death, and will one day return, bringing heaven down to earth with him. Thus, though our faith is inescapably political and will shape our local communities, our hope is not in any of the cities of today, but in the city that is to come, descending from heaven with Christ at his triumphant return, when all of creation is brought fully under his rule. How is it then that Christian wisdom differs from the worldview?
Yeah, so something, I guess I can't speak to how much of a thing this has been for Catholics, but for evangelicals, for probably about 20 years now, maybe 30 years, there's been a very popular movement called the worldview movement that wanted to talk about how Christianity is a worldview, which is to say it's this comprehensive account of reality that shapes the way you see everything in the world, a worldview. The problem, I mean, so far as that goes, that's true. Christianity should shape the way you see everything. But what happens is that we start to develop these very contrived categories of a singular Christian worldview and a singular Marxist worldview and a Muslim worldview and a materialist worldview. And what it teaches us to do over time, it teaches us two things, and they're both bad. So one is all of this stuff is kind of automated. And so you go to your Christian worldview guru and you read his books and you kind of download his answers to questions that may or may not be, like, even be being asked by people around you. You download his answers into your head, and now you're ready to regurgitate them when you need to. So you don't actually mature in knowledge of the faith and knowledge of God and intimacy with him, because you're just regurgitating what you heard at your worldview summit or whatever it might be, or your classroom. The other thing is it teaches you that your neighbors, who are made in God's image, who are deeply interesting people, actually aren't that interesting, because they all just can be distilled down to this single worldview label, depending on whatever their worldview is. And so it kind of absolves you of the responsibility to listen, because all you need to do is listen enough to peg them, oh, Marxist worldview, oh, existentialist worldview, and now you know how to kind of quote-unquote deal with them. And so it's a really horrible way to view neighbors, and yet that is how that kind of thinking can, I don't think it's meant to do that, but I think that's often how it ends up working itself out. And what I would say is a better approach is what a friend of mine that I work with in Davenant, he refers to as Christian wisdom. And so Christian wisdom is something that you cultivate over time. And it's cultivated through conversation and through listening to Scripture, first and foremost, also listening to the voices of the historic church and of your pastor and your neighbors in the church, and just encountering the world on a day-to-day basis. And so there's a line Barry has in one of his novels. He dumps all these questions, his character does, on the seminary prof. And the prof looks at him and says, you've been given answers to which you cannot be given questions. You will have to live them out little by little. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the idea of wisdom, is that you, as you encounter Scripture and as you encounter God's world and as you submit your life to his rule, you over time acquire wisdom, and that is what equips you to be able to talk to people and really listen to them and understand them and be hospitable to them and then speak to them about Christ in ways that actually are compelling, that actually connect their real life experience. The missionary Francis Schaeffer, he used to say that if you have an hour to talk to somebody about Christianity, he would spend the first, I don't remember if it was 45 or 55 minutes, mm-hmm. but a good chunk of the time just listening and asking questions. And if you acquire wisdom, you can do that, because you know how to ask good questions and you know how to listen and you know how to respond to good questions from them. If you just have a worldview, you may or may not be able to do that, because a lot of it is going to be scripted and a lot of it is going to be read through this kind of artificial grid of Christian worldview, Muslim worldview, and so on. So I think we need to be encouraging wisdom in people, and that's a much slower, messier thing, but it's also going to be a far better thing long-term than encouraging the kind of rote answers that you often get with worldview.
So you talked about the fact that we must be a wise citizen, but you write also we must be humble. In what way can we be humble? A humble citizen?
I think I come back to the Sermon on the Mount a lot. There's an emphasis that Christ seems to place on lowliness, on service. When you encounter Christ in the gospel, you realize the way Tim Keller puts it is you're more wicked than you ever dared imagine, but more loved than you ever dared hope. So when you confront that wickedness in your own heart, it humbles you. I have a friend who said you should never assume, we've been talking about a prominent Christian leader who got divorced, And he said, you should never assume that divorce can't happen in your own marriage. And so when you live with that reality of your own sinfulness, it should transform the way you see your neighbors. And so it's going to necessarily make you a more humble person, I think, because you know a little bit of your own heart and what God has forgiven in you. And so that should equip you not to be scandalized by neighbors, but to see them and say, yes, I'm capable of that too. And then to love them in the midst of that. And that's going to be a far stronger position for you to sit in as a citizen, as a neighbor, as a parishioner, living with that recognition of your own need for Christ. Because then you're not going to be shocked or scandalized when it turns out that other people need him too.
In the couple minutes that are available to us, say a little bit about this final point. When you write, at best, our life in this world is simply an opportunity to tell people about God, the gospel, heaven, and hell.
There's a line at the end of The Chronicles of Narnia by Lewis, where he talks about the Pevensey children have died, and they're now in Aslan's country. And Lewis talks about how that wasn't the end of their story. It's actually the beginning. And it's the first page of the greatest story that they will ever experience, they'll ever live. And so the point there isn't to minimize the life that we have now. The point is to recognize that we're eternal beings made to know God. And so the good things we experience today are foreshadowings of something beyond our imagination. We're given this time now to follow God in difficulty, to follow him in pain, and to offer the hospitality that he shows us in the gospel to our neighbors. And we are able to do that because we know that his promises to us are sure. So the resurrection of Christ, that's a down payment. It's God telling us that he's serious about renewing the world and renewing us. And we can look at the empty tomb and know it. And so that then equips us to tell others that there's another world coming, and we can live into it in small ways today. Will you join us? And so that's a very hopeful position that we can take, I think. And we can take it because we already know what's coming, because the tomb is empty. Christ is risen.
Our guest this evening has been Jake Meter, title of the book, In Search of the Common Good, Christian Fidelity in a Fractured World. Jake, thank you so very much for being with us. And you and your book bless us in many ways.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
All right. Good night. God bless you and your family.
Good night. Thank you. You as well.
Final thoughts. He writes, the good news of the Christian faith is that these things will not fail, and that the delight we derive from them today, delight that God smiles upon since he is the giver of the gift, will continue on into eternity, world without end. Christ promised to his people to come to our rescue and renew both us and the world will not fail. Even when the church has been compromised and assailed both within and without. These things will not fail when the world itself seems to be failing, and they will not fail at the end of all things when God returns and creation is laid bare. And the reason they will not fail is that in their goodness and beauty, they reflect the goodness of God, who is eternal, the God for whom and to whom are all things made. Don't forget then how precious life is and how powerful love is. Tell someone now that you love him or her. Pray for peace as if it depend on you alone, and come back next Sunday and amplify with us.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Whatever happens today, take it on with a fresh cup of True Brew Coffee. Now only $1 with True Rewards. True North Store's True Brew Coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. As a free True Rewards member, pick the size that is perfect for you and pay only $1. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
You're jamming your favorite song, and while you aren't missing a beat, you could be missing a signal from your body. It's an SOS from your kidneys, and it doesn't sound like music at all. It's silent. High blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, and other risk factors can quietly stress the kidneys, leading to negative impacts on the heart. That's why you should ask your doctor about a simple urine test called UACR. Most miss the signal for hidden kidney disease and related heart risk. You shouldn't. Visit detecttheSOS.com today to learn more.
In communities across the country, hourly Amazon employees earn an average of over $23 an hour with opportunities to grow their career and their paycheck. Learn more at aboutamazon.com.